Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm here again, as always.
Yeah, and also welcome all you people who are fascinated with the personalities involved with all things culinary.
Well, we've got a few of them today.
We have a few luminaries. That's what I call them, luminaries today.
And we call this a mixed bag since we start in Birmingham, Alabama, and finish up in Brazil. And make a stopover back in these United States, amazingly enough, but with a star cookbook author writing all about fruit, and then a fascinating individual who started cooking in Spain and then took his Spanish cooking to London, and he called us all the way from there to talk to us. So if that doesn't sound like an exciting morning, I don't know what does, so stay with us, and we'll get going right away.
Frank Stitt, you are a larger-than-life hero to the whole of the South and Southern cooking. You almost never got back there, right?
Well, that's true. After kind of running away right after high school, I thought that I might stay in France for a while. I loved it in the South of France. But who
doesn't?
But I was able to come back and to kind of bring the foods and the cooking that I've grown to love and to cook, whether with Richard Olney in the South of France or in California, and to kind of incorporate my love of Alabama with the things that I'd learned.
Yeah, now you are a native growing up just, is it north of Birmingham?
That's right, just 1 hour north, a little town of Coleman, which was a real prosperous agricultural community. And my mother's parent, the grandparent Whites, they had a wonderful farm with chickens and Jersey cows and pigs. There was a smokehouse. They had the most unbelievable garden with everything from asparagus to, they would sell strawberries commercially, and field peas and beans and corn. And so that, as a child, I would go out and with my brother and sister, and we'd play on the farm and help pick things. And so some great memories as a child in North Alabama.
Yeah, it's an experience you can't really explain. It just makes such an enormous difference to your attitude about food, huh?
Well, I think so, about food and about, you know, just say for me, the summer lunch and that farm table with butter beans and little pink-eyed peas and cream corn and boiled okra and tomato salads and cornbread, not much meat, but the things that came from the garden, those humble vegetables, I think just are what still inspire me in many ways.
So you lived farm to table. Now, a lot of people are just discovering farm to table as if it's new, but you actually lived it.
Well, via my grandparents, and my mother was just a wonderful cook, and my grandmother made just the most incredible biscuits in the morning. And I remember on the Southern table, I tell the story about this blackberry cobbler that she would make for 4th of July when all the cousins would come. And the biggest pot she had was a wash tub, and she would bake the blackberries with this wonderful crust in this wash tub so that there'd be a big enough pie for us all to have.
Well, now, we invited you to join the program because we met recently at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival, and we were surprised to learn, well, not surprised to learn, but we had never received a copy of Bottega Favorites, which of all things for a Southern cook is an Italian cookbook. Now, explain that, please.
This, Frank, is one of your restaurants. Maybe you should just list all of your restaurants.
Well, certainly. I opened the Highland in 1982.
The Highlands Bar and Grill.
The Highlands Bar and Grill. And so that was my first restaurant where we weave our Southern ingredients into kind of a provincial French way. And 6 years later, in 1988, I opened up Bottega in a beautiful building, this limestone building, just three blocks away. And inscribed in the limestone was the name, Bottega Favorita. And this was built as the premier clothing store of the time. And I think the name came from this idea of an artisan making his craft in the back and then selling it in the front. And that was this idea of the bottega. And so we named it Bottega. And that is our Italian restaurant where we have a casual side and then the main dining room, which is more beautiful walnut panels where we can focus on regional Italian cooking.
Because you had to call it Bottega Favorita, otherwise you'd have had to change the limestone.
Exactly. You know, I was just being a cheapskate.
Now, it's not really surprising. On the surface, it may be, but you explain in the book, as does your forward writer, Warren St. John, by the way, is a beautiful writer.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful. But anyhow, what are the similarities between Alabama and Italy?
Well, first of all, there is the direct connection with polenta as being one of the staple foods in Italy throughout kind of the povera cooking of Italy, and of course our grits. And so when polenta is made right with organic, freshly milled corn and dried corn, just like our grits is, and so they both kind of form the big part of the kind of the rural food experience. And so there's another thing with the love of greens. You know, Southerners just can't get enough mustard greens, collard greens, poke salad, turnip greens. And the Italians have a similar love with their Tuscan kale and with their chard and with all of the different greens that they sow from north to south, that they're really health-giving in their love. And, of course, there's the cured pork. There's pancetta, and there's our love of bacon and side meat and fatback and lardo in Italy and prosciutto and country ham here. So those are, and then there's the love of beans, just simple beans, whether they are Barlotti beans or cannellini beans or our butter beans and our pink-eyed peas.
What was your epiphany, though, to saying, you know, I need to do an Italian restaurant?
Well, it was one of those things as kind of an evolution from I love the focus of Highlands having with our provincial French and Southern. And I was kind of felt like I was diluting it when I started to weave in some of the Italian food that I wanted to cook.
Uh-huh.
And so instead of doing that, I said, well, this beautiful building, why don't we bring this more rustic, this almost more ancient way of cooking in an Italian tradition, investigate all the different regions and bring my love of the seafood market in Venice and the market in Florence and my love of Italian wines, the Barolas and Barbarescos and the Barberas from the Piedmont.
And the simplicity,
exactly.
An elemental level.
The Italians have a way of just being happy to have some sliced prosciutto and a melon or a fig, or just an arugula salad with some shaved parmesan and olive oil and maybe a squeeze of lemon. And so there is this simplicity, this elemental way that I wanted to be able to capture with Bottega.
Now, your previous book, which I think we're going to talk a little bit about again, one of the interesting things you did about that was you organized it around the seasons. Now, this book's organized slightly differently.
Well, it is to a degree. Now, one of the things that was so great about the Southern Table is that Christopher Hersheimer, the brilliant and my most wonderful dear friend photographer, captures all of this. She came 1 week each season, and so we were able to shoot things at the peak of their seasonality and at the lighting of that time of year.
I remember you told us that. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, and so we did that actually with three seasons, and then one other week we were in Italy in the Piedmont for the truffle fair and for the slow food fair. And so we approached it very similar, but the Bottega is much more of the favorite foods that we cook there for the last 20 years, and whether it's short ribs and oxtails with a little gremolata, and whether it's a little asparagus with shaved parmesan, or the Venetian spinach. And so there's just a world of food that we just do with Bottega.
Well, you sort of interweave your own takes on these. It's not just translating Italian cuisine to your restaurant. And you actually have little, what would be called them, little stories that go along with a lot of the recipes.
Yes. Well, you know, and I'm just thinking about the piadines, which are these almost like a pizza sandwich salad combination. So there's a real flat pizza dough, but with very little sauce, very little cheese, but you build a salad on top, fold it over, cut it, and one is a Persian piadine. My wife Pardis family is Persian, and so we incorporate cucumbers and scallions and dill.
She's gorgeous, by the way.
Well, she is the most gorgeous person. Yeah.
And I love the, what is it, Persian breakfast. I thought that was very interesting.
That's right, with walnuts and radishes and feta and yogurt and scallions and just and lots of herbs. And they're just a healthy, just wonderful tradition that the Persians have.
I love two of the things you wrote about. One was tripe.
You
wrote about discovering people would be cooking tripe over in a corner, and they'd been cooking it for days and days and days and days before they even sourced it.
Exactly. You know, this I stumbled upon. I'd heard about this guy in Florence, and that he's had a little cart, a push cart, that he sold this tripe. And they go to such lengths to clean it and wash it clean, and then they cook and cook and cook forever, and then they combine it with this incredible tomato sauce and parmesan, and then cook it for hours and hours more, and you get this wonderful texture and this just slightly gamey flavor, nothing like menudo or some of the other things, or chitlins, which kind of, you know, I just run away from.
Because I guess you only eat chitlins at somebody's house when you really know them very well, I heard.
I think you're right there. You got to believe in them.
But I liked your Venetian liver story where you cooked,
you cooked
the liver properly, and then it was somebody in your kitchen who said he liked liver the way his mother had cooked it, which was within an inch of its life.
Right.
And he tried your preparation and said, boy, isn't that wonderful?
Well, he literally teared up. This was this big old football playing African American who loved his mother's beef liver that was cooked forever, and then he tried that tender, delicate, sweet veal liver with caramelized onions and butter and polenta, and it is we have people that when we have veal liver, we call them and they just rush down to the restaurant.
So that's something you can't always get, I guess.
Well, that's right, and it's one of those things that, you know, I think a lot of restaurants are scared to offer because they think that not many people will have it, but we've got kind of a reputation for doing it in a style of Harry's Bar from Venice.
Right. Well, we both love it, and I let you into a little secret. I can find it sometimes at the local Whole Foods market, previously frozen, but it's naturally grass-fed beef liver, and they used to be only $1.99 a pound. Now they've found out people buy it, so it's $3.99 a pound.
I think selling it as pet food.
It's in the section with the pet foods.
Well, but you know, and it's such a nutritious thing, and not that you want to eat it every day, but it is really, I think we have an obligation of utilizing the whole animal and appreciating all its different parts.
No, I get it every 2 or 3 weeks, and it's so quick to fix because it cooks so fast.
And it's organic, or it's all natural, so you don't get any, liver is the last place that all these nasty toxins end up in your body.
Oh, let's not talk about that.
All right.
Let's talk about the
pastry chef here. Is she not Sunny?
Well, Dawn Lester Miles, she and I have worked together for over 25 years, and she's just part of our restaurant family, and the tiramisu and the thing that she's holding in that beautiful picture
is
an almond dacquoise with little local kumquats from a local farm. But that is this crunchy almond layers with buttercream and genoise with this almondy just essence that is so, so good.
Well, I mean, she just lights up the page, too, with that smile.
Well,
amazing.
She certainly does. And she, like I say, she started with me at Highlands back in 1982, and so we're still working together, and I love Dawn Lester, and she is just a brilliant, brilliant cook. You know, one of the things that she does, we kind of combined a couple of recipes in this Zabaione meringue cake. And I love a Zabaione with the flavor of Marsala and the kind of winey nature of it. And we do that with in between layers of cake and then cover the whole thing with meringue and then torch that. And it is just one of the greatest tasting desserts ever.
Look, here's this short ribs and oxtail with gray malata and green olives. I mean, is that gorgeous?
You know, in that the green olive and the little orange zest make it just kind of pop. You know, it's a wonderful braise to begin with, but the olives and the gremolata just kind of really brighten it all up.
I also liked your lamb shanks with peas.
Oh yeah,
which I never would have thought to put in there.
Well, and that's kind of seasonal for right now, and I think that it's lamb to me is I eat it for all the year, but
yeah,
I do like
too,
to focus on it in the springtime. And sweet peas and mint are just this wonderful, wonderful combination that, you know, and we serve it with rice, a little rice pilaf. But braised lamb shoulders and lamb shanks are two of my favorite foods.
Now, we must not let go by something that we talked about before we came on the air about your love of seafood and the fortunate aspect of the fact that Birmingham's a first stop on the seafood trail north from the Gulf.
That's right, and a lot of people don't realize how great our seafood is. It comes from Apalachicola and Bayou La Batra and Panama City and the Gulf Coast in general, for the pompano and the snapper and the grouper and redfish and the trout and the shrimp and the crab meat and the oysters. And so because Birmingham is, you know, just a few hours from the coast, but often the Greek restaurateurs were the main restaurateurs of Birmingham. They had connections with the fishermen on the coast, and so they would ship some of the best, freshest fish here to Birmingham. And a couple of my purveyors, Greg Abrams and Lee Fish, they've been working with me for over 20 years, and just today we received some of the most beautiful fish. The tuna that is so nice, we're going to do a little tower. We're using it cubed raw with little shrimp and avocado and roasted peppers in a tower.
Oh, wow. You're making me very hungry, Frankston.
We're good.
So let's recap the two books that we're talking about. The latest one is the book. And you are a prime mover in the whole revival and expansion of Southern cuisine, and you're a hero in that regard. Do we need any specific website information?
Oh, well, the HighlandsBarnGrill.com is kind of the where you can go, and there are links to Bottega and Chez Fon Fon.
Oh, yeah, that's another one. I don't know about that one. I mean, I've read about it, but what is it?
You forgot that one when we asked you about your restaurants. You only mentioned two. Let's get the third one in there before we close.
Chez Fon Fon is right next door to Highlands, and it is the most beautiful and most charming little French bistro. And we have this great garden out back where we have a boule court.
Oh, how cute.
And we do just greatest pâtés, moule frites, steak frites. We do escargot and frog's legs, and we do right now a blanquette de veau with veal breast and spring vegetables, and so it's just my love affair with French bistro food.
Well, Frank, we're just, like you told us before we came on the air, we're just going to have to come make a visit. That's all there is to it. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on The Menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was great talking with the two of you, and I can't wait to have you in Birmingham.
We are, Kip. Let's go before it gets too hot.
That's right.
Frank, thank you.
It's my pleasure. It's great talking with you.
You too. Bye-bye.
And now it's time to take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. This is the point in the show where every week we say, please check out all the things that are going on through our website. Communicate with us, read articles in print, look at pictures of the places we've been, stay in touch. And somebody who has actually stayed in touch is, we're welcoming back Deborah Madison.
Back,
yeah,
maybe.
Another.
I think she's back in record time.
She is, indeed. She's doing a lot of writing there. Deborah Madison, she is a star in the cookbook field and the writing field, and a delightful person to talk to.
Deborah Madison, you have one very, very pretty book here. It's entitled Seasonal Fruit Desserts from Orchard Farm and Market.
Hold on a second. Let me say something at the beginning of the interview, which I usually don't do.
Okay.
The fascinating thing is I just asked Deborah, because we had Deborah on the program just recently about another book, and I said, how do you manage to do two books so close together? It's sort of like the publishing equivalent of playing a doubleheader in baseball, but doing it every day for a week. So how come?
How did that happen?
Yeah, how did that
happen?
Actually,
it's deception. I did turn the book in. I turned those two books in the same day, if you can imagine having two books due on the same day.
Wow.
And that was about 2 years ago. So actually, this book has been done for a while. I'm not really that, and it took me a long time. I worked on this book for about 5 years.
And it's an absolute celebration of fruit.
Well, thank you.
Isn't that the way it started out?
It actually started out, I wanted to do a dessert book because I've long been involved with desserts, and I wanted to call it Desserts for the Pastry Impaired because I wanted to take desserts away from kind of the skills of the pastry chef.
I understand. Being one of those people that you just described, I understand.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the impaired, not the chef.
Well, I myself am... would never call myself a pastry chef. I don't have that kind of ability and dexterity, and it doesn't really even interest me.
Patience.
Yeah, and patience.
A little OCD helps too, I think.
Yeah. But I view myself as a cook, and more of a cook than a pastry chef, and that's kind of the sentiment I wanted to bring to this book. And fruit, of course, lends itself perfectly to cooking.
Before you get into it, I mean, we should mention that you were the founding chef of Greens in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and you have numerous cookbooks, and many of them award-winning. You have nine cookbooks, right?
Actually, I think it's crept up to 11.
But yeah. Well, with these
oh, my
two,
goodness.
With the
oh,
11.
My goodness.
And, yeah, and so, and you were, as I said, awarded Beards and IACP and so forth, and you write regularly for magazines. So now I brought everybody up to date, and let's get back to writing this book.
Okay.
Telling us.
Okay, well, let's start out with best two pages I've ever read in a cookbook, I think.
Oh, yeah? You didn't tell me about that.
It's called 10 Tips. And there are probably 10 tips for just about anything you do in the kitchen.
Hmm.
But I absolutely love the way in which you said, be at least a little bit organized.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it definitely helps. You're right. It helps for any situation in the kitchen, but especially with desserts. I mean, you don't want to be looking for the right pan, you know, as your egg whites deflate. You want to kind of have a few things lined up in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And just open it to that page.
Here it is, yeah. Be somewhat organized, and then protect the pie crust.
Well, yes. A lot of times, you know, especially cooking with fruit like plums, they may seem rather dry when you put them into a crust, but they exude a tremendous amount of liquid, and it will make the crust soggy. So a simple device for that is just to scatter some broken up cookies, biscotti, or even breadcrumbs or crushed walnuts over the bottom of the tart pan or the pie pan, and then put your fruit on top. And those things will absorb the juices, and they'll give you a nice, fairly crisp crust.
Otherwise,
it'll also just leak and burn if you're not careful,
well,
too, right?
Do you remember when we were first in Australia and I decided to make strawberry pie?
Oh, yeah, well,
I had never baked before, actually, and my mother was this great pie maker, and I remembered bits and pieces. Now, I lined up my strawberry. Well, I remembered that she pricked the crust, right, with the fork to get holes in the bottom of the crust. I didn't realize that after that you baked it, so I pricked the crust, then put the filling in.
Well,
was a mess.
This,
well, there's always learning by doing, which is the best way. You only have to do it once.
Oh, yeah, I would never do it again.
Well, this was after you went to a supermarket in suburban Geelong, Australia, and tried to find out where they kept the frozen strawberries. And nobody had ever heard of any such thing, and they didn't do Crisco either. Just to give you an idea, not only is this a beautiful book, it's such a sensible book, because the tip after protect the crust is freeze your fruit.
Yes.
Which is something that Anne's been doing for years. So
great.
We have our own raspberries from our own garden all year round.
How lovely.
Because Anne freezes them, and then we buy flats of blueberries, and she does the same thing. And now she's been experimenting with mangoes and melons.
Oh, that's good. But cherries was a real revelation.
Yeah, cherries are fabulous if you never tried
them. I actually just looked in my freezer, and I still have pie cherries that I froze last summer, which I better hurry up and use because I don't want to be using them when the fresh cherries are out. But certainly, if you're able to get fruit that has fabulous flavor because it's locally grown, it's from your backyard, it's from your market, and you have an excess of it, it's such a gift to have it during the year. It's going to taste far, far, far better than something that's come from thousands of miles away. That's all there is to it.
And listen to this one, listeners. Even if you buy the fruit, if it's local at the time, it's also going to be a whole lot less expensive than it will be trying to buy nectarines and peaches in January.
Well, that's true.
Not to mention persimmons.
No, not to me. Well, you can't buy persimmons at any time of the year. They're so ludicrously expensive. But tell us some more about the structure of this book.
Well, it really does emphasize fruit, and particularly fruit that has wonderful, full, rich flavor. So starting with that, the book opens with the most simple, the most healthful, the most simple desserts, which is simply to bring fruits in their season together, either in beautiful fruit platters or on separate plates. Sometimes there's a little something that might make a simple fruit slightly more exotic. For example, grapefruit sections with a little pomegranate molasses on it. It's a simple gesture.
I'm just looking at that now.
But it changes it. Or I move quickly into compotes, too. So right now, a dish that would work for the end of the winter season is a citrus compote with orange caramel. But it opens really with simple fruit and nut combinations, sometimes the inclusion of an herb, of a flower water, of a liqueur, but basically very straightforward fresh. And then I move into compotes. After that, into roasted fruits. And then it goes in lots of different directions. I pay a lot of attention to dried fruits because...
Yeah, I noticed that. I thought a couple of illustrations of a dried fruit compote, I guess you would call it. And it's so good.
Oh, yeah, it is. And it's so simple that every time I make it, I think, gee, did I leave something out of this recipe? But I didn't. It really can be very simple.
Well, why do I screw it up all the time? Because Peter loves this stuff.
You don't screw it up at all. He's great.
I thought you didn't like it.
No, you do it very well.
Oh, your sister's is so much better.
Well, anyway, this is a very, very simple compote of mixed dried fruits. But then, you know, I also look at individual fruits, like there's one of dried figs that are poached in wine.
You know, you must be reading my mind, because as I open these pages, you tell me what I'm looking at.
Oh, I guess I am then.
How funny.
I love that picture because it has bee on it.
You know? Yes.
The bee found it very tasty. But I felt dried fruits were really important to look at, and not only dried fruits, but nuts as well, and cheeses, because one is, farmers markets often offer some really exceptional dried fruits, and you can buy them in supermarkets too, and they're actually quite good. If you're going to ship dried fruits, it's not like you're shipping a perishable item. There's something that if you're traveling, you might pick up in a farmer's market. But most of all, they really are what makes sense in the winter, more than any other fruit except citrus, I suppose, and apples and pears. There's something we can really rely on. And for people who are trying to eat more seasonally, it's a good way to go.
What is your Swedish connection? Because you have a lot of Swedish inspiration.
I have three Swedish creams. When I was pastry chef at Café Escalera, I had an assistant who brought me this recipe, and she called it a Swedish cream. It's very much like a panna cotta, but it has sour cream or creme fraiche, and then I started playing around with the whole idea of it, and my favorite version, I have to say, is made with maple sugar, which has just a lovely, toasty, rich, you know, caramely flavor.
And just in case you don't know how to make that, listeners, that's at the beginning of the book, right? So you have the toolkit of things that you might want to go along with your fruit, you already know about by the time you get into the recipes.
Yes, in fact, along with the Swedish creams and a cream cheese mousse, a ricotta mousse, and fresh cheeses, I have five cakes and a few other things that basically are vehicles for accompanying fruit.
I thought that was clever. Cakes to go with fruit. I thought
that
was very smart.
And these are cakes that are all quite different from each other, even though there's only five of them. But they work so nicely with fruit through all the seasons of the year.
You see, our mothers and grandmothers knew this automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, they knew a lot automatically, particularly about seasons. But now we're relearning it, so
yeah.
Hopefully this will be an aid in that direction.
So what are you working on now?
I'm saying nothing. I kind of coming out of the aftermath of two books in such a short time, and I don't know, I'm doing some writing, mainly essays and things like that, but I haven't started a new project because I'm kind of busy with this one.
But you're living in New Mexico?
I live in New Mexico, yes, near Santa Fe.
You see, I've never been there, and I'd love to go to Santa Fe.
Yeah, we tried to arrange it a couple of times, but it's sort of not really on the way to anywhere.
No, it's a destination.
We always tried to figure out if it was on the way somewhere.
We
never quite managed to make it work.
Now, I understand.
I think there's a great way to wrap up this interview, and I'll explain why in just a second, because the front of the book has the most gorgeous picture of strawberries.
Is it raspberries? They're raspberries, aren't they?
Well, I'm looking at it upside down. I guess they are raspberries. Well, it's a strawberry story anyway.
Because
it's really funny. Strawberries are in your neighborhood supermarket far more months of the year than they ought to be. I'm sure you would agree.
Oh, yeah.
But I want you to tell the story of your husband and the strawberries from Southern California.
Oh, yes. Well, my husband has always said he doesn't like strawberries. And I was in California at a farmer's market researching fruit, you know, for this book. And there were some beautiful strawberries. I mean, they're the way strawberries should be. I mean, they were red through and through. They were incredibly aromatic and perfumed and just fantastic, the way a supermarket strawberry never is. So
we were just in Paso Robles and had their strawberries from the farmer's market.
Yeah, in strawberry season. So we bought a box of strawberries.
And just ate them.
And that's what we had for breakfast 2 days in a row.
Oh, how nice. So I bought a few quarts of these berries and carried them home. And I said to Patrick, I use that nursery rhyme, you know, open your mouth and close your eyes. I'll give you something to make you wise. Which when I began to think about it, that's a pretty crazy thing to do, to open your mouth and put something in your mouth you can't see. There has to be quite a bit of trust there, and he trusted me. And I put a strawberry in his mouth, and he ate it. And he said, what is it?
he didn't even know what it was.
No, I said, that is a strawberry. That's a real strawberry. And so what he didn't like when he didn't like strawberries were those kind of hollow core, tough, berries that don't really have any aroma or flavor. But when faced with a real strawberry, he just lit up.
So that's the story of the book, the story of the real strawberry and the story of all these other wonderful desserts and all the tips to make you more successful. Deborah, what a pleasure to once again have you on the program.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is mine.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay. I hope so.
Bye, Deborah.
Bye.
And now time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. You know, I'm kicking myself because I really wanted to ask our next guest if it was his great-great-great-great-great-great-whatever-grandfather who conquered Mexico and took it over from... Was it the Incas or the other ones?
I don't know.
In Mexico. No, the Incas were in Peru. Who was
the
Aztecs in Mexico. Because Pizarro is certainly associated with that piece of Spanish history. But Jose Pizarro... of a London restaurant and food establishment called Brindisa, blazed his own trail from Spain to my native land when Spanish cuisine was hardly there, and he helped to introduce it, and it's now one of the most exciting and interesting cuisines in the whole of the London area.
And this is a book that, you know, I like to point out, because there's so many cookbooks out there, this is a book that belongs on any serious cook's shelf.
There you go. So we're talking not only about his restaurant and his enterprise, but also about what's behind his lady's cookbook and
seasonal Spanish cuisine.
And we were excited, so excited that he took the time to call us all the way from London to be part of the program. So I'm sure you'll be interested in what he has to say.
Jose Pizarro, you're calling us from the UK. Hello?
Hello.
Yes. And with your wonderful cookbook, is this your first cookbook?
It's my first cookbook, yes. I contribute in different, just giving recipes to different books, but this is my first baby.
Well, it's has been really enthusiastically received. It's called Seasonal Spanish Food, and mm-hmm. it's subtitled 125 Simple Recipes Bring Home the Flavors of Spain. And doesn't it just do that, huh?
Yeah.
Now, you have an introduction by one of my most favorite people, Elena Arza, and we were talking before. Isn't she just simply wonderful?
She's a wonderful person, the same than all the family, you know, her father, you know, her mom, all of them just people that you really go into them, because they're just so down to earth, and they are just lovely. Lovely people.
It was so funny, Jose, when we were interviewing Juan Maria and Elena, sitting in the edge of his kitchen. We were asking him questions, so he decided to ask me a question. He said, "How old are you?" it turns out that we're exactly the same age.
Yeah, okay.
And so he was very pleasantly surprised, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And then another of our friends, Jose Andres.
Oh, lovely person as well.
Yeah. You Spaniards are really great.
So the thing is, the Spanish people, the American people, we are so lovely. We really want to enjoy life and be. It's why I think American and Spaniards go well together, because we love life. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And Spanish people, I think we are lovely. That's for sure.
Now, tell me about this move you made from the second. From the center of Spanish cooking to the second center of Spanish cooking, the city of London, where I used to live and where you now live. This is not exactly a normal migration for a Spanish chef, I wouldn't think.
Why not? Can you repeat that question, please?
Let me do that again.
Yeah, why basically did you decide to move to London from Madrid?
Why did I decide? Because I met a friend of mine in Madrid, and she was telling me it's very big gap in London for good Spanish chef, because it was in that time, 11 years ago, was not many good Spanish restaurants here.
Okay, now you were perfectly right. And
it was nothing. It was, I remember when I came here, it was like two good restaurants, and the rest...
Yeah, which one were they?
I don't want to say they were bad, or really bad, but wasn't authentic Spanish food.
Who are those brothers that we always...
Well, we know the Hart brothers, Fino and Barafina.
Lovely people.
Yes.
And also...
Lovely people, lovely friends.
And there's also a restaurant called Moro,
which they recommend very highly. Yeah. But when I came here, it was nothing, almost.
Right.
Was Gaudi, and was is World Cambio de Tercio.
Uh-huh.
But no really, really authentic, you know, tapas bar, you know, with the ambient to go there, busy, noisy, you know, quick, beautiful food, simple on the plate, and was no at all. And slowly, if I see back 11 years ago, now it's plenty of very, very, very good Spanish restaurant here.
Now, you're at your restaurant now, Brindisa, isn't that in the Borough Market near London Bridge?
Yep. Yeah, we opened Tapas Brindisa 6 years ago, and we were very well affected, you know, busy since the first day, and we're still very busy. We, you know, my restaurant here is 40 sitting, and we do 3,000 customers a week.
So you're a busy guy. Now, you also bring in a lot of Spanish produce as well, correct?
Yeah, we have another company, they import Spanish food. To the country.
Well, now back to the book.
Yep.
It's lauded for being authentic, and yet mm-hmm. you admit that you modernize a number of these. These are not the recipes that your grandmother made.
The thing, my mom and my grandmother cooked some of these recipes, and the only thing I did to her recipes was just to adapt it. Adapting, you know, the time of cooking and the presentation, but I try to reflect in the book the old recipes as well, no? But with new technique.
Yes. And you emphasize, which I think the best of Spanish cooking emphasizes, the ingredients themselves.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Sometimes I feel like I am a lazy chef, because the only thing I do is buy the best ingredients
uh-huh.
and cook very simple.
Well,
sometimes it's not very easy to have good ingredients.
Oh, I know. Especially if you're dealing with seasonal in England.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's in the book.
Yes.
In the book. Ingredients, simplicity, easy, and quick.
And you know, I'm looking at some of these photographs. This tomato salad with smoked paprika looks absolutely divine.
Yeah.
All it's got is red and green tomatoes, some red onion.
Yellow tomatoes.
How simple can it be?
Herbs.
But how simple, but how amazing flavors. It's something that you really want to put in your mouth. You know, simple, beautiful tomatoes, pimenton, onions, nothing there. But when you put that in your mouth with that vinegar, that smoked paprika coming to you, amazing. Just love it.
Now, are you reflecting a particular region of Spain where you came from, Jose, or are you basically covering ideas from the whole of Spain?
I try to cover all the Spain, but of course, to be from Extremadura, I really want to put my area on the top, no? But it's coming, all the recipes is all around Spain. You can have the paella from Valencia, or you can go to pulpo, octopus, a la gallera from Galicia. You know, I try to cover more or less every part of Spain, but emphasis in my area.
You also, as you're highlighting these ingredients, you're giving wonderful explanations of what to look for in them, what their significance is, and how to prepare them.
Yeah, the thing is that so many people, they ask asking me how you look or how I buy the best chorizo, and you know, it's why in the book I try to explain people the way to buy the ingredients. And as well, if you can get some ingredients, I explain how you can buy quite similar ones.
Sure. So you're really empowering people, even though they may not have all the access that you have, to be able to produce something very close to the same flavor. I think that's great.
Exactly. It's so important. I told you before when I started thinking about the book. For me, it's so important people cook from the book. Go to the supermarket and say, okay, if I can get a Picos Blue coming from Asturias or North Spain, I can use another different blue cheese to cook that recipe. It's so important for me that.
And you have some unusual recipes not typically found in cookbooks, such as your recipe for pig's ears.
Now, the challenge, I guess, is laying your hands on some pig's ears.
But yeah, I think it's lovely. I grew up in a small village in Extremadura, and La Matanza means when we kill the animal in winter. We have the pig hair there, and we have to use it, and it's lovely. And the recipe is so simple and tastes amazing. Nice glass of wine, and it's amazing tapa.
Yeah, I mean, these recipes are very creative, and you're obviously very passionate about this style of cooking. I mean, your morcilla recipes are fabulous. Scrambled eggs with morcilla, sautéed morcilla with mint oil. Now, that sounds just divine.
It's just watering my mouth.
Me too.
But it's an important thing. I really want the people, you know, watering the mouth when they are watching or reading the book. I want they go and cooking some recipe from there. I want they bring friends and family to cook from the book. That is why I really want emphasis in my book. You know, it's really the thing I want people to do from my book. Bring people, enjoy cooking, and have a lovely time.
Yeah, I mean, it's so helpful, this, like your section on saffron. Less is more, you say.
I feel like that.
Yeah, and you know, but you have a whole entire page talking about using saffron, which is very distinctive to Spanish cooking. And then you have a whole section on paella, and a lot of people misunderstand paella, right?
I think paella is a wonderful dish.
Oh, yes.
So is a dish that you want to cook for friends and family and enjoy that time. People think that paella is difficult, but it's not. And you can make paella with so many different things. You know, it's just vegetables, rabbit, chorizo. So you have
snails.
Very, very complex nails. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, rabbit, oh, I love it. With some green beans and some...
That's we cooked outside, we learned. We just visited Valencia.
You're gonna have to go off and get something to eat here.
I'm telling you, I feel like that now. I just coming from the market. I'm lucky enough to live very close to Borough Market as well.
We love Borough Market. We have friends there. Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful place.
What's our buddy who does the mushrooms?
Well, you must know Tony Booth of the Wild Mushroom.
Tony Booth.
He's
Tony
been there
Booth
for
is my
years.
Best friend.
Yeah.
We have been chatting, Tony and me, about the asparagus, the season of the asparagus is starting very soon. The white asparagus are ready in from Sevilla.
Really?
And the wild asparagus is starting, well, I got some ready for dinner tonight. And green asparagus from England starts in 2 weeks.
Wow.
That is not amazing news.
Yes,
isn't that just wonderful? Well, listen, we're absolutely drooling, but we promise ourselves, we promise you that next February, because we come to London about that time of the year every year.
Oh, lovely!
We're going to come and visit with you and check out whether you're making the same things in your restaurant and in Brindisi as you are in the recipes in the book.
Yep.
Well,
and in the meantime, I'm going to dig into some of them and see what I can make of them myself.
Yeah, I must say that I find this book really extraordinary, and I have shelves full of Spanish cooking books, but this is just, I don't know, it's a very special take on Spanish cuisine.
It's very familiar because, you know, Spanish people, we are very close to family, and this book is so for my parents, like you saw in the cover. And I think I tried to put there all my passion for my family and for the food when, like, I grow up, you know. So important.
Well, it's here, and listeners, I mean, this is a book that has to be part of your collection, and you're just going to fall in love with the recipes. And also this sweet looking little pig, but the whole article is about the pig slaughter.
I was thinking to put in or not, but I think the people need to know about the La Matanza, about how for us was so important to kill the pig, and we went through a horrible time. We were very poor in Spain, and the pig was almost the food for all the year. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean,
and I think the people need to know that.
And you need to use every single bit of it. This is true. Maybe, can I ask you something that I ask everybody who's a Spanish chef who knows about Spanish food? Espardenyas. Do you know it?
No. Espardenyas.
Espardenyas.
No, well, Jose's from Extremadura, so...
Yeah, so you wouldn't have it, but it's popular in Barcelona. It's very seasonal, one short season, and nobody will tell us exactly what it is. I think it's sea cucumber.
Yeah, sea cucumber, no.
See, people tell me no also. So what is it? It's very expensive. It's a fish.
Expensive. Yeah, it's some little part of something like a sea cucumber, and they take whatever the guts are that they cook, and then they throw the rest of it away. That's about all we know.
I think next time I need to do it. I will know better.
Okay, you have to tell us when you know.
I will tell you in February, next time when you are coming here.
Great.
For sure.
Oh, Jose, I'm in love with this book. I think it's just great. And everybody else seems to be too. You've gotten wonderful reviews. Aren't you pleased? I'm sure it was a lot of work.
Having a lot of work, but I'm so happy.
It's a winner.
Say again?
It's a winner, a keeper, this book. It's just great.
No. Okay, thank you very much for that. I'm really pleased to hear that.
Well, I can't tell you how much I look forward to meeting you in person, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
No, it's a really pleasure.
And continued success.
Thank you very much, Anna. Thank you very much, Peter. I'll see you very soon.
Right. Adios.
Adios, amigos. Gracias.
Gracias.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
A break one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I'm glad you stayed around for this last segment coming up, because it's something you're going to be hearing a lot about, I think, Brazilian cooking. This book is called The Brazilian Kitchen, and let's just go right to it.
Leticia Morenos-Schwartz, hello and welcome to On the Menu.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Leticia, you are in a desirable position now, because your native country is taking center stage as we look forward to the next Olympic, right?
That's correct.
And that's a real coup.
That's 2016, right?
Yes. And we also have the World Cup coming up in 2014.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, there you go.
That's a big one.
Can't look at that one yet. They still haven't played the 2010 one.
Yes.
London's when, Rabbit?
London Olympics is 2012.
Okay, so that comes next.
But the World Cup's in South Africa in September 2010.
Okay. And I just heard that Beckham just tore his Achilles tendon. So
he did,
yes.
Yeah, so
playing,
he's not playing, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So
I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, football is big in Brazil, is it not?
It's the national religion. It's a religion. I have to tell you that I watched the 1958 World Cup, and as a Brazilian, I'm sure you know who Brazil beat in the final.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Go ahead. Go on. 1958.
No, you tell me.
I wasn't born then.
The host nation, Sweden, was in the final.
Oh, that's right.
And they introduced a new star who was then 17 years old. His name was Pele. And everyone saw Pelé and a winger called Garrincha for the first time. But let's talk about food.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost as important, I think, as soccer in Brazil. And tell me this, Leticia. You were born not only in Rio, but you were born near Ipanema?
Yes. Yes, right on the beach.
You were born on the beach. That's great. And you grew up there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you got, what, the idea of cooking?
Well, I started to cook as a young girl, watching everything that was happening in the kitchen. But I never really knew of the profession of a chef as a very official profession. And then in one of my trips to the United States as a tourist, I visited the French Culinary Institute, and then I clicked, you know, kind of like Julia Child when she enrolled at Le Cordon Bleu.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was, I always knew that this is what I wanted to do, but I just didn't know that there was a school that you could officially become a chef.
So, and you did do that. You came to New York and entered the school and trained, and then what happened?
Yes, I enrolled at the culinary program, and I loved it so much that I stayed for the pastry arts program. And I was in New York, I was single, and I was, you know, just immersed in the restaurant life. I worked at that time in many French restaurants. We're talking here like 1997, 98, 99. We were still living the glory of French cuisine. And I worked at many wonderful restaurants like Le Cirque 2000, La Caravelle, La Grenouille. And it was really a wonderful experience.
But at one point then, you moved to Connecticut?
Right. When I met my husband, he was living in Connecticut, and I was like, yeah, okay, all excited. Okay, I'm going to continue working in restaurants. But it didn't take me too long to realize that the restaurant scene in the suburbs is not quite as fierce as in New York City. So I started to teach cooking classes. And through those classes, other opportunities started to come as well, like catering and wedding cakes and chocolate orders. That's when I started to realize that was kind of like out of touch, and I was beginning to be homesick. And that's when the idea of you know, doing this cookbook was born.
But you write that you actually realized that your taste had changed and matured, and it was very modern, contemporary. So these recipes in this book that you've written called The Brazilian Kitchen, subtitled 100 Classic and Contemporary Recipes for the Home Cook, lightens and modernizes many of these traditional recipes, right?
That is correct. I think that one of the things that I noticed is that I used to love all the recipes, the original recipes as they were when I was a little girl. But as your palate trains and you start training your technique, I thought that I could incorporate and refine a little bit of some of our dishes. I'll give you one example. There's a wonderful dish which is based on yuca and shrimp. It's called bobó de camarão. And in the old kitchens of Brazil, we boiled the yuca and we put it in a blender with coconut milk. But it, as you go to cooking school and, you know, in the first class of dealing with potatoes, you learn that every time you put a tuber vegetable, such as potato or yuca for that matter, in a blender or a food processor, the result is gooey.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I try to do with some of the recipes. You know, I said, okay, let's do this the right way, which is mash the yuca, which it does take a little bit of more elbow work than the potatoes.
Uh-huh.
But the result is a little bit more refined, I think.
Now, the definition of Brazilian cuisine is that it combines Portuguese, African, and Native Indian cuisines. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And some of our most famous dishes are...
Feijoada.
Feijoada, that's right. We're very famous for that one, which is a black bean stew with lots and lots of different kinds of meat and sausages and pork cooked inside. And it's actually original from Rio, that dish. So I've been eating every Saturday of my life.
I see. I used to make it, too.
I love the way you said you can put pig's ears and all kinds of things like that, but you usually take the pig's ears out before you serve it.
That's right. I think that the flavor of pig's ears is fantastic. I mean, many people are turned off by the idea of eating pig's ears, but the flavor is there, and you can always remove it, so why not?
I like it served as barfed, crispy fried.
Yeah, we were at a restaurant in Greenwich Village where that was a bar snack, and it was as a tasting for us with cocktails.
Yeah.
But it was highly processed, refried, chopped up, but it was still pig's ears.
Yes.
Right.
Now, so you have a recipe for feijoada in this book. What are some of the other ingredients that are, yucca, we've mentioned that. You have a lot of yucca recipes.
A lot of yucca. Some people say yucca, some people say yucca, yuca.
Yucca.
I don't even know what's the right way to pronounce. But yes, a lot of our dishes are based on yucca, as you say.
Now, it's sort of a joke in my house because I bought it for when we lived in Kansas City, we had some strange supermarkets, and I bought that. I was going through a book of rare vegetables, you know, and I wanted to try all of them. And Peter's determination was it tasted an awful lot like candle wax.
Yeah, and his proper name was Yuck.
Yeah, but I think that it really gives an earthy tone to dishes that potato cannot do.
Uh-huh.
I think it probably has to be good yucca, and it probably has to be fresh, and I'm sure it has to be fixed the right way.
Yeah.
And it fell short on all three parameters when we had it in Kansas City. So
my fault.
We haven't had it much since then.
Hopefully you'll try some of the dishes with yucca then in the Brazilian kitchen.
Okay.
Maybe.
All right.
My hands on some yucca.
I have been duly challenged, and I will take you up. I will take up the challenge, and I'll let you know.
Yes, and you can call me on that. I'll be happy to help you.
How about this now? How traditional is this tilapia with acai sauce? I mean, acai is so popular now because it's an antioxidant. And, I mean, it does come, does it not come from the Amazon? No, that's a different source. Where does it come from, acai?
No, you are right.
Oh,
it
okay.
does come from the Amazon. I think that, I don't know if you're pronouncing acai. I've heard it acai.
Yeah, acai, I think.
Acai, right. And I think that it became more popular after a dermatologist, Nicolas Pericone, and then Oprah put it on their show, and he started to explore using in his cosmetics as a very powerful fruit. And now it's even changing the economy of that region because we are exporting so much. There's like more than 3, 4, 5 companies that are doing juices with acai.
We've had someone on the program talking about that, and we had some samples, and it was really very good.
Isn't it wonderful? And I have to say, the taste of acai, once you taste it here, it's not even as fresh. It's delicious, but not even as delicious as it is in Brazil, because there it's even more fresher. So it's so good. In acai, I eat acai in Rio out of a bowl. It's like it's so pasty, it's so thick that I can eat it with a spoon, the juice, instead of drinking with a straw. So delicious.
Now, any other favorites of yours from this cookbook that you want to get mentioned to entice people to buy the book?
Oh, I love every single recipe that's in this book, I have to say. But there are a few of the iconic dishes, like the pão de queijo, which is the cheese bread.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. That looks really yummy.
I eat that every day. Oh, my God, I can live on cheese bread. That is something that I'm totally addicted to. Another recipe that I also love are the brigadeiros. I think that those two dishes are very easy to prepare at home. In fact, the whole book, that's my whole goal, is I try to write the book in a way that people can really incorporate Brazilian cuisine into their home kitchens, just like we cook Italian and French and Chinese or whatever. I mean, that's my goal. And they're all recipes prepared with, you know, easy procedures, easy to find. I give substitutes. And I would say that today it's so much easier to find the ingredients. You go to the supermarket, you know, and you can shop local and eat global. So it's very easy to access the ingredients.
But if you want plantains, for example, and you want yucca, they're being grown somewhere other than the United States, so they have a few miles on them.
That is true, but I think that in every supermarket there is now an international aisle.
Oh, yes. Now, I agree with what you're saying, that you certainly have much more access to the ingredients than you once would have had. But in a way, you're not being terribly green, because this thing called food miles, they obviously have a lot of food miles on, because they're not being grown anywhere within a few thousand miles of Pennsylvania, for example.
Right. But one of the things that I actually say in many of the recipes is that what's so fascinating about Brazilian cuisine is that when people think about Brazilian, they mostly associate with exotic ingredients, but not, I think that it's more of the combination of ingredients that are not so popular. But we have many dishes that are based on chicken, carrots, onions, potatoes. You don't need to go to even the international aisle to prepare Brazilian cuisine.
Right. Now, is there a particular subset of spices that are typically Brazilian?
Yes, we do have one spice called pimenta malagueta, which is a type of kind of like a red side chili in the family of the bell peppers, but a hot pepper. And you can certainly substitute that for Tabasco sauce or ground chili peppers.
Okay, so there's an element of spiciness that's in a lot of the recipes.
Yes, a lot of ginger, a lot of coconut, a lot of lemongrass, a lot of dende oil too.
Yeah,
dende oil, are you familiar?
Yes,
with that?
So that's African in origin, isn't it?
Yes, and that has a very distinctive flavor. I wouldn't say it is spicy. It's more like a, how would you compare, maybe to a saffron-like kind of flavor? And it's very distinctive, and we use it a lot.
Well, I think that people buying this book are going to enjoy your background information and your introduction as well, talking about place of food traditionally, historically in Brazil, and also how the scene has changed, how various French chefs or any, I mean, American, French, whatever, like the trois gros chefs adopted the influences of Brazil. And then you really want to get them all together, Leticia. You tell them that if they cook this food, they're going to end up looking like you. Very, very lovely picture of you examining fruit.
Oh, you flatterer, you. and having said that before, Leticia's head explodes to twice its normal size because of the nice things you said. We probably should let her go back to making some feijoada or some...
And Portuguese soup, the caldo verde, which I adore.
Or whatever. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Leticia, much luck and success. And I'm going to look forward to trying these dishes.
Thank you so much. I hope you do. I do have to study more of my history on soccer, though. That I have to admit.
yeah, you do. If you, to be a real Brazilian, you have to know it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I just don't have it on top of my head, but I'll certainly train on that.
You'll get there, I'm sure, as 2016 gets closer. I mean, 2014 gets closer. In fact, I don't know how they're going to broadcast the South African events, but I'm sure we'll get them. I remember the last World Cup, I had to get up and watch England play at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were playing Brazil, I think, and they gave up two soft goals in a match they should have won, and I was so disappointed because I should have been sleeping instead.
Right, right. Yeah, no, we have to follow the times.
Yes. Well, thank you again, Leticia.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so nice. Such a pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go. You got a little overtime again this week, but I'm sure you didn't mind. I'm sure you found it was a fascinating program, and I can assure you we'll have another equally fascinating program for you next time. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.